is, in the name of the one who said them, brings redemption to the world. At the end of the shiur, remind me to explain why. Okay, I don't want to go into the reason for that, why that is so. Obviously, there's a virtue in not, of course, certainly not plagiarizing somebody else's ideas, and in fact, saying over ideas that you heard from somebody else in that person's name, but what does that have to do with the redemption? What does that have to do with Gula? So, I don't want to explain that right now, but if you remind me at the end of the shiur, I'll try and explain that. I wanted to do an analysis of the relationship between the Dor HaMabul, that's the generation of the flood, and the Dor HaPlaga, that's the generation that built the tower, the generation of the dispersion. These are the stories of two societies, both of which, it seems, were engaged in a certain kind of corruption, and both of which were punished by God, but there were two different, each one met its own fate. And I want to analyze the relationship between the two. Now, in doing so, I'm basing myself, for the most part, on ideas of Rabbi Chait. Many years ago, Rabbi Chait gave over an explanation, a shiur on the Dor HaMabul, but he treated it as two separate subjects, basically. And analyzing what the underlying sin of the Dor HaMabul was, and he gave a separate shiur on the generation of the dispersion, and he defined what their sin was, and why the punishment was appropriate, and so on and so forth. But that's as far as he took it, for whatever reason. And just recently, this past year, I came back to the subject, and I worked out some new ideas showing a developmental relationship between the two. So, in order to be able to follow these ideas, first of all, you have to understand the basic analysis of the of each society, the society of the flood, and that's what I intend to do. And as I'm saying, those are not my ideas. I don't want to make it appear that these are my ideas. Then the last part of the shiur, in which I try to show some new elements in terms of a development. That's basically what I worked at. Okay? Alright, I just wanted to make that clear. Now, let's start off with an analysis of the Dor HaMabul, the story of the Mabul. This is fascinating. This is fascinating in its own right. And it enables us to study the Torah from a different dimension. In other words, the purpose of studying Torah is to get to the underlying ideas, the concepts, the philosophy behind the stories that are depicted in the Torah. And if we study it properly, it opens up many, many areas that affect our lives, the life of society, and provides the answer to certain questions that all of society has to contend with, which we would not really be able to understand. Issues, for example, of war and peace, issues of nationalism, whether it is possible to find a political solution to the international problems that confront the world. Does the Torah have a definitive statement on something like this? I think that if you study these stories we're going to do on a deeper level, you'll see that the Torah speaks to these issues. And without the Torah, you'd have no way of really arriving at this type of an understanding. All right, let's therefore begin with the story of the Dor HaMabul. Alright, it would appear, if I ask you where does this story begin, where would you turn to in the Chumash? The story of the Mabul, where would you turn to? To Noah, Parshas Noah. Okay, first the Torah introduces us to Noah. He was a tzaddik, obviously, he was apart from his generation. And it tells us that he had three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Now, this is in Perek Vav, Yud Aleph, it says that the entire world had become corrupted before God, and the world was filled with violence. So there are two elements over here. There's the elements of corruption. Now, what is referred to by corruption? What type of corruption? That's a loose translation. It's referred to as what? A breakdown of all the sexual restraints, as the commentaries point out. And then it says that God saw the land, and behold, it was corrupted, for all flesh had corrupted its way on earth. Now listen, simply speaking, it means all of mankind. In terms of the area of sexual behavior. It implies that they, first of all, had lost all sexual restraints, and they had broken down all different forms of barriers. Deviation, sexual deviation of every type. I mean, to a large extent. It wasn't just a contained type of thing, but it was widespread throughout the entire society. That's what it says, that's what God saw. And then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the world is filled with violence. Now the violence is a different type of thing. That's a different type of corruption in terms of the relations between man and man. A lack of respect for the property of others. Violence. Stealing, murder, that type of a thing. So, and behold, they've corrupted the earth. No. I'm wrong on that. And I am going to destroy. I'm going to destroy them from the earth. With the earth. From the earth. It means that that's God's promise that he will destroy them. That he's going to destroy the world. So, what would you say is the sin? What is the sin of the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood? What's the essential? It would seem that there are two elements over here. Which one would you say though is the more prominent one? Are they being destroyed for the sin of the Hamas? Or are they being destroyed for the sin of the sexual breakdown? Yeah?
The sexual breakdown is emphasized.
The sexual one seems to be emphasized. Also, as we'll see, the story of the flood doesn't really begin over here. It begins at the end of Parshas Bereishis, as we'll soon see. Most people associate it to Noah. But it seems a little bit strange, because it seems to have, it says, Vatishaches. The first description seems to be in Pasuk Yud Aleph, in 11, the entire earth was corrupted before God. And then it says, and the land was filled with chametz. Well, first of all, you know, the Torah should highlight the essential one, which seems to be the factor of the sexual. When it says that God saw the earth, it mentions the fact that it was corrupted sexually. It's a little bit strange, but it says God saw that it was corrupted sexually. But then when he spoke to Noah, he didn't mention that. He mentioned the factor of chametz. So it's not that simple to understand what exactly was the essential defect for which they were worthy of being destroyed. Also, it would seem that there is a relationship between the two. I mean, we could ask, is it simply by accident that it just so happened that you had these two? Was there some type of a pattern that we could learn something from? Because when you're describing what you've noticed in a certain society, so you could say, well, I noticed this, I noticed A, I noticed B. It doesn't mean that A and B always go together. You can't draw any conclusions. It's more than just that. I'm telling you over that there's A and there's B, and I'm going to show you that there's a relationship between the two. That way you learn something more. That is to say, you learn that whenever you find A, you better watch out, because pretty soon you can have B. So that's a different kind of a concept. All right, so that's the first question. We want to try and elucidate specifically what the essential sin was. At this point, the Ramban, I just want to point out the Ramban without giving the full explanation, just what he says. He says, in explaining the indictment, because God presents the indictment and mentions it to Noah, only mentions the factor of chametz, the violence. It doesn't mention the other one. So the Ramban, by way of explanation, says that even though they had indulged in all of these corrupt sexual practices, nevertheless their fate was sealed, their lo nechtemu gzar dinam, their fate was sealed only because of the sin of violence. So that brings us a little bit closer, but if that's the case, if that's what sealed their fate, what does he mean by that? So then why mention all the other things? This is the essential. Does he mean that that's the essential one? What does it mean to seal their fate? It's not that clear what that means. So we're going to try and elucidate that. But that's the first question. Now, the second question with regard to the Dor HaMabul is something which, if you read the Chumash superficially, has got to be astounding to you. It just begs for explanation. Take a look at the whole series of Sukkim describing what takes place after the flood, after the marvel. After the entire world was destroyed and Noah was saved, then he comes out. He comes off the ark. God gives him the command to come off the ark. That is in... Where is that? That's in chapter 8. And in Pasuk, what is the first thing that he does when he gets off the ark? Take a look at Pasuk Chaf 20. What is the first thing that he does? He builds an altar and he brings sacrifices to God. He brings sacrifice to God. The Torah does not mention at all that Noah brought sacrifices before the flood. He brings the sacrifice to God. And then in verse 21, of course you can't take this literally, obviously. It must be understood allegorically. It says that God was very pleased with the sacrifice. God, so to speak, smelled the pleasant aroma. And then God said to himself, I will no longer curse the earth because of man, for the inclination of the heart of man is evil from youth. And I will no longer smite all living beings as I have done. And from now to the end of the for the rest of the days of the world, then there all the seasons and so on and so forth, day and night, all the various seasons and times will no longer cease. In other words, God now takes a promise that he will no longer do this ever again. They'll never bring a flood upon the world to destroy all of mankind. Okay? Now, what's difficult about what we've just read? What's difficult? The question really is, why? What is the reason behind this promise not to do this again? Wasn't it the just thing to do? I mean, Hatsur Tom Paulo, the rock, his works are perfect. Everything that God does is perfect justice. So, do we mean that in the punishment of the generation of the flood there was anything lacking? Wasn't that perfect justice? Wasn't it the correct thing? So, if that is the correct thing, so then why is God saying that he will never do this again? Why is God saying, I mean, if, let's assume, man still has free will, I assume, after the flood, man still has free will, and the flood was a punishment, so therefore, if man would ever reach a state where he would deserve the same type of punishment, does it mean that God rescinded the punishment? God said, I made a mistake, it wasn't the correct punishment? Absolutely not, that doesn't make sense. So, either or. If there was something wrong in the punishment of the flood, so why did God do it the first time? On the other hand, if we assume that it's perfect justice and it's the correct thing to do, so then why does God say he won't do it again? He should do it again, if it happens. I mean, it's one thing to say it won't happen, that man won't do this again, but that's not what he's saying. God's saying, I won't do it again. It's like a promise that we have some kind of protection here. Some kind of a double jeopardy or something. But philosophically, it doesn't make any sense. Rachel points out, that's a good question. God in fact does give the reason. That ties into the next question. The reason is very strange. God says because the inclination of the heart of man is ra menura, is evil from youth. So that's why he's never going to do this again. Well, wasn't that the case before he committed the crimes? It was just as evil from you then as it's evil from you now. That it's not a new thing that just came into being. It's not something that we overlook. In our framework, you know, that could happen, that you punish someone because we're using our best judgment. And afterwards you discover something about the person's nature. Had I known that the person has this type of a thing, I wouldn't have punished them. But obviously we can't say this. So Rachel is saying if that's the case, then man shouldn't get any punishment. Well, the answer to that is that this statement doesn't mean to say that man doesn't have free will. The Christians interpreted it to mean that man doesn't have free will, that man is evil by nature. That's the Christian interpretation, which of course is false. But first of all, was, I think the stronger question is that this was certainly the case in the generation of the flood. Moreover, take a look, go back now, let's go back now to the, as I said, the story really does not begin at the beginning of Noah. It rather begins at the end of Bereshit. And see if you could find the pasuk which is almost a direct contradiction of this one. Where does the story truly begin? Anybody at the end of Bereshit? The story of the flood, it's good to know, begins in Perek Vav, which is at the end of Parshas Bereshit. And it describes a process. See, it didn't happen suddenly. It wasn't a sudden cataclysmic experience. It was an evolutionary phenomenon. It developed. It went through a process of development. It took a few hundred years for mankind to reach such a state. That process is described in chapter 5. But what does it say? Take a look at Pasuk Hei. And God saw that the evil of man had increased upon the earth. And now, V'chol yetzer machshavos libo rak rak kol hayom, and all the inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the day. So one second, compare this pasuk to the pasuk which we're just very similar to the pasuk here. We're saying that he will not destroy man because the yetzer lev adam, the inclination of the heart is evil from you. That's why I'm not going to destroy him. But in the pasuk which states that God is going to destroy, what's the reason? Why is God going to? Well, the very next pasuk, Yinochem Hashem ki yoses adam, then God the regretted, so to speak, that he created the Adam. Why? Because God saw that the inclination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil all the day. So, I mean, the very same idea that of the evil inclination in man, on the one hand, is given as the reason for destroying him, which again, of course, I'm not saying that this by itself makes sense, because if that's his nature, so then why'd you create him that way? I mean, itself must be understood. I'm only bringing it in terms of a contradiction. But whatever the case is, if man must be destroyed because of his evil inclination, so then how could that same factor be utilized as a reason for promising that he's not going to be destroyed because he has an evil inclination? You see what I'm saying? In other words, these are just different offshoots of the same basic question. So these are very serious problems, I would say. Very serious problem. Okay. Coming up, we have the two questions. First of all, we would like to understand what exactly was the chait. We'd like to understand what the chait was of the Dor HaMabul with regard to the two elements, the sexual and the violence. And secondly, we'd like to understand the reason for God's promise not to bring a destruction upon the world again, which it doesn't seem to make sense, because if that's justice, then that's always going to be justice. The justice doesn't change. And also the specific reason, because man's the inclination is evil from youth, which doesn't seem to explain it. Which doesn't, that, as we said, that was certainly the case the first time. In fact, that's mentioned as the reason why he has to be destroyed. Okay, let's take a look at the process of the deterioration of the society of the flood. As I said, where does the story begin? Take a look at chapter 6. There's a process of development, and there are certain key steps in the process. Where does the process begin? Anybody? What's the first step? The first step in the process is in the next pasuk, in pasuk Beis. And it says that the sons of, now it's that word Elohim is referring, there's different interpretations. What? These are right. Ramban learns it's talking about the mighty ones, like judges, the leading people, the elite. They saw the daughters of man that they were goodly. And they took for them wives from all that they chose. Now, in those few words, the Torah is describing a process of a breakdown of sexual barriers. They became attracted to the sexual. Now, we see that that's the case. Well, the word itself indicates that they saw the daughters of man that they were goodly. In other words, that they became involved in the enjoyment of the sexual, the romantic, and so forth. And then it says that they took wives mikol. Now the Ramban says the implication to from all means that they took, they didn't observe any type of restraints or restrictions, but whatever they desired, they took. Whether the woman was married, not married, it refers to forced relations, it refers to rape, and so on and so forth. They began to indulge themselves, their sexual passions. Now the proof that that is so is you see in the very next pasuk, and God says, my spirit will not abide in man forever due to the fact that he is flesh, and his days will be 120 years. That's the famous Isaiah may have yes mshana, which is really a misunderstanding, by the way. It doesn't mean, for some reason people got the idea that this is like a blessing, that a person should live 120 years. This is the correct number of years, right? You know, Admeya. It just means to say that his days will be 120 years. Between now, I'm going to give him 120 years to repent, or else I'm going to bring the flood. That's what it's talking about. It doesn't mean to say that I'm going to get, it doesn't make sense. He's so totally corrupt, my spirit can't abide, and I'm going to give him 120 years. It doesn't make sense. But it means to say that from this point on, I will give him 120 years. That's in God's, why 120? I mean, only it's God's infinite wisdom that this is the amount of time that the society deserves. So God is giving them a chance to correct their behavior. But what does it mean that my spirit will not abide? The Ramban, there's different interpretations, but the Ramban has a beautiful interpretation. And it means to say that this, what is my spirit? It means the soul, the neshama, the tzelem elokim, the divine element. Now, it means like he has chosen. See, man is not divine by nature. By nature, he's a creature, he has free will. He's got an instinctual component, but he also has the divine component, the capacity to live in accordance with his reason. But he defines himself. So once he begins to, once he chooses to be in, to follow the direction, the course of his instincts, so he becomes like any other animal. And the power of the Tzelem Elokim begins to weaken and weaken, and it's no longer manifesting itself. In that case, a man deteriorates, and he becomes just another animal, a more dangerous animal, because he's an animal with intelligence. And that's what it means. My spirit will no longer abide. If he continues along this path, he will destroy. Man has the capacity to destroy the force of the divine element of the Tzelem Elokim within him. If he allows the instinctual component to become so powerful that it simply wipes out the power of his chokmah. And that's basically what the Ramban has said. He says the matter is because God made man correctly, perfectly, to be like the Malachi Asharis, like the ministering angels, with the soul that he had placed in him. But he was drawn after the flesh. B'shagam u'basa means after the flesh, and taiva, the physical desires, and nimshal kabahemos nibu, living just like any other animal. And therefore the spirit that I placed in him will not abide within him, because now he's become physical. He's become a physical being, not a divine being. Okay? But he says, but the promise, avol yarech lahem im yoshuvu, but God is marachah, God, so to speak, we use the term long-suffering, God will give man a chance to recuperate, to improve himself. That's the first step. The first step is then a breakdown of the restraints, that a person is only man insofar as he observes the restraints. And it doesn't mean to say, we're not saying there's anything evil in terms of the physical enjoyments, but of course, in the context of a life which is based upon the restraints of his seichel, and his tzelem elokim determines the path of his existence and it shines forth. That was the first step in the breakdown, but God gave him a chance. And of course, if man chooses, you see, man exists only because of the will of God. Alright? And therefore, if the will, God's will relates to man, if God's will ceases to relate to man, then man can no longer exist. And God's will relates to man only insofar as he lives a life in which he's defined as man. But man does not have the option to choose to live like an animal. If he changes the definition that God gave him and he desires to live a life like an animal, like many in our society today, they just want him to live in the physical. So then he has no right to exist, and he can't exist because God's will not relate to him. Of course, the only question is, at what point in time do you have to factor in the element of tshuva? And only God can say at which point in time a society has reached a point where of no return, point of no return. But the world always faces that possibility. And that's the concept behind the marvel, is perfect justice. Because man has no inherent right to exist. He has no inherent right to exist. He exists only because of the will of God. So he exists only insofar as God's will relates to him. When he changes his nature, a man is the only being that has this power. Because the animals follow their nature. By instinct, they have no choice. But if man does have choice, and therefore if he chooses to be something different, then God's will does not relate to him, and he has no basis for existence. That's the marvel. That's what happened. But then the process continues. Then it says that the next step, what's the next step? In 5. And God saw that the evil of man had increased in the world, and v'chol yeter, and all of the inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the day. That's the second step. There was yet one further step. And here, of course, we're not talking about anything to do with violence. Here it's all sexual. It began with the sexual. What is this? What took place over here? What's the feature? What's the essential feature of this step? Anyone? Increase. See, it started out among a certain group, the elite, the leaders, and then it began to become, see, it's one thing if there is a manifestation of a certain type of a behavior. It's a symptom. It's serious. It has to be dealt with. But it can be contained. If it's contained to a small segment of the society, it can be dealt with. But then it goes beyond that segment. It becomes widespread. So there was an increase. One was a quantitative increase. It spread throughout the entire society. Rabbah, it increased. And the second one was a qualitative. What was the qualitative? You'll find this situations where people conduct business. You know, they're creative and constructive during the daytime, but at night they're wild partying all night long. So half the day they're involved in just the gratification of living like animals. Right? But at least the other half of the day they're still involved in something constructive. So to a certain extent they are partaking of the higher part of man, of something creative. But here it's ra, what does it say? Rak kolayam. In other words, it's totally consumes him. All of his thoughts, all of his involvements. There's no room for any other activity. So that's a worsening of the disease. Now that was step number two. Now you tell me at this point, it's quite serious. It's quite serious. And it says that God, it doesn't say that God actually decreed anything yet. It just says that God regretted. Of course, it's not an emotion. Anytime we use any of these types of things, we don't mean that God had the emotion of regret. It's something that we would view. It means that man was no longer in line with the will of God. And this was, for a being like this, God would not have created the world, would not have created man. For this, this was not in line. That's all it means to say. The only reason why, if that's the case, why does it exist? Again, because God gave man free will. What was the next step? At a point in time when you sort of made up your mind, this is what I'll have to do, but you're still giving it, there's still hope. Right. There's still a chance for a reprieve. But basically this is the direction where it's going to lead, where it's going to. Because something new came into the picture, and that sealed the faith. What was the new element? Chamas. Yeah, up until now, we haven't read anything about Chamas. We're saying about Chamas. Chamas comes into the picture in Parshas Noach, where it states, in summation, now in verse 11, first it digresses to tell us about Noach, and then it comes back to the story of mankind, and the world had become corrupted, that's the sexual, and the world was filled with Chamas. Now, how do we understand that? What's the connection between the two? Yes. Well, yes, this is a very significant point. And there's a universal principle that we deduce from this. That's what I wanted to get at. Is it just so happens that they had these two elements, or is there an inherent relationship between the two? See, according, there's an inherent relationship between the two. It's not just by accident. See, many people claim, especially, and this is why it's relevant to our society today, many people that, because this idea, the idea of the Dharma-mabal, that there should be an abolition of any type of sexual restraint, that type of area, there's no objective right and wrong. And it doesn't reflect upon the goodness of man. In other words, that a person can be what we would call totally free sexually, and at the same time, be ethical and respectful in terms of the other area of between man and man. In other words, those who claim that there's a dividing line between the two areas, and a person can live like an animal in the one area and be decent and respectful in the other area, yeah, this holds an impossibility. That's simply not true, and you'll see our society, I mean today, that's the sexual revolution, which maybe I guess a little bit before your time, but it's not before our time. of the 60s. You've maybe heard about the 60s. That was the idea that was current then, to break down. It was an age of rebelliousness, to break down traditional morality. And that was the hippies, to just live or go off and commune. Traditional marriage is obsolete, and traditional relationships, and a person can have multi-relationships. And again, anything is good. Anything that you happen to enjoy, any type of sexual gratification is good, as long as you don't harm somebody else. That was the base. So they're trying to maintain that idea of, that we're moral people, if we have a superego of not harming our fellow man. In fact, they tried to emphasize the whole thing of love, was emphasized. You see, I guess there's a denial that there was any type of aggressiveness. So that became involved. And what happened? What's the result? It unleashed in the last, this is something you're familiar with, there's been a tremendous growth of violence and crime in this country like we've never had before. Tremendous breakdown in the year in terms of every form of theft, illegal insider trading and violence, mugging, killing, the increase in terms of murders and new types of phenomena that were unheard of have become commonplace. Serial killers and the level of I'm just giving certain examples that come to mind. The Central Park jogging, you've heard about that case, no? The total loss of any type of respect for human life, and for the slight cases you read every day, For the slightest insult, a person, you know, takes that gun, starts shooting, and people get into a dispute about in a car about one guy cutting another guy off. There's been, if you're just aware of what's going on in society, there's been a tremendous increase in the level of violence, and you can't separate the two. You know, this whole, the two are intricately linked together. Why? Because once a person fools himself when he thinks that he has a certain desire. He has a certain desire, and it's wrong, but he's just going to indulge himself in that one area, and that's it. I'll just have that one particular thing. I'll indulge myself. And then, for all practical purposes, I'll be the same, except for that one thing. Now, once you indulge yourself, once you give in, so you've lowered your level, you're now functioning like an animal. You're functioning on the instinctual level. Now, once they broke down the controls over their instincts, it didn't just stop at a certain series of instincts. See, man's either instinctual, or man is living on the human level, on the level of control. If he's living on the level of control, then he has to maintain control over all his instincts. And the instincts of lust are extremely powerful, so are the other instincts, the instincts of greed, the desire to have what's not yours. See, the desire to take advantage of your fellow man. Very, very powerful instinct. So once you allow yourself as an individual to give in to the lustful part of you, it overcomes the mind in that area, then it's going to be the same thing. It's a matter of how you function, and the same thing for society at large. Either you're functioning in a situation in which you're in control of your instincts, and you're able to subdue your instincts, and to work them out in an intelligent, proper way. That doesn't mean that they can never be gratified, but they are completely under the control of the Talmud Hakim, or else the Talmud Hakim has been defeated, in which case you are now at the mercy of your instincts, and if that is the case, it won't stop at somebody else's property, because those are extremely powerful instincts. So, because then you're functioning as a behemoth. So that's why the Torah brings the two together. It's not just see, we disagree with contemporary philosophy, which says that sexual behavior is, has nothing to do with any other area of life. And it's become extremely relevant in terms of the whole issue about homosexuality and another type of question that affects society. Yeah, the two, there's no doubt, anyone that studies our society, going back to the 60s, you see virtually a replay of what took place. And it's not just, by the way, it's not just amongst the populace at large, but it is a question, it does begin with the leaders. It used to be that an individual, I'm not saying that this should be the correct standard, in politics, for example, if a person was divorced, he couldn't run for any significant office. He could never run for president. I'm not saying that should be that way. I'm just going, it's just an indicator of how seriously people took things like marriage and commitment and so on and so forth. But certainly if the person was caught in an affair, he had cheated on his wife, then that's it. Of course, as we know, today it's not no big deal. Certainly if a person was divorced, it's no big deal. And, you know, during the campaign, I mean, I'm not bringing up anything you don't know about, but this whole thing about Clinton with was pretty open, pretty overt, tapes and so forth, that he had an affair with someone for many, many years, and it wasn't an issue. People, let's get to the real issue, the economy and so on and so forth. The character issue is not a factor. It's become completely accepted throughout the entire society. So there's no question that in our society you could see a correlation between the two in terms of a serious breakdown and this of society. And as I said, without the Torah, I don't think anybody would really be able to make this point. I mean, you'd make some observations, but from the Torah, see, we have a tremendous advantage on how to interpret what's going on, because we know the underlying principles of how man and how societies function. Alright? Now, what does the Ramban mean when he says that even though they engage in all of these sexual practices, their fate was sealed because of the Hamas? Why was their fate sealed because of the Hamas? He says because that these laws pertaining to respect, not to kill, not to steal, and so forth, those basic laws are what he calls rational laws. You don't need a prophet to reveal these things to us. Any society of intelligent people, on the basis of their own rationality, would be able to figure out that you have to have these things, or you can't have any basis for civilization. So it means to say it's a reflection of the extent to which man's rationality was totally destroyed. In other words, man is only man insofar as he's a being with a telem olkim. Now, in practical terminology, that would mean a being who functions according with reason, with rationality. He's a rational animal. So he began to deviate, and to be, the power of the animal factor, the instinctual, became greater and greater, but there was still, as long as there were windows, see, God did not bring the destruction, as long as there were areas in which the rationality could manifest itself. So as long as it was restricted just to the sexual, but in regard to other areas, he still had sufficient intelligence and control to recognize that it would simply destroy the society. So then it showed that his rationality was still functioning. So there was hope. But once it carried over into the realm of the violence, and which was a complete violation of all the norms of rationality, so that showed that he was totally destroyed. He couldn't function anymore as a human being. That's what it means, l'nechnu gzantinam, that the fate was sealed on the basis of the violence. But it all goes together. The fate was sealed meaning he had reached a level where he was no longer functioning as a telem olkim, and he'd simply become an animal. And as we said, he can't exist under those terms, because he only exists by virtue of God's will, which will not relate to him unless he's in line with God's will. What's that? That he should be a telem olkim. That's part one. Okay? That is basically the story of the Dharma model. Now the question that we're going to leave with, we'll come back to it, is what was the underlying cause that brought this about? If we can get an insight into that. What was responsible for this deterioration? Is that it, as far as we can go? Or was there some element in man, perhaps, that was responsible? And we do see that God does make a statement, or a promise, whatever you want to call it, that he will no longer destroy the world, which would indicate that the marble, we have to look at the marble, was the marble simply elimination? Was it a punishment? There's two kinds of punishment. In one case, the punishment means you're destroyed. That's it. Just eliminate the sinners. But nothing has changed. You just eliminated the sinners. Or no, the marble was not just an elimination of the sinners, but it brought about certain changes in the nature of reality. Okay, we'll return to that theme in a short while. Okay, that the marble was more, was an onish. In other words, when we speak about God's punishment, the punishment is always measure for measure. The concept is that the punishment is intended to better us somehow. That God's punishment relates to our sin and enables us to overcome them. Puts us in a situation where we're forced to grow with the defect. Now, does a marble partake of that element of punishment as well? Right? Now, there would seem to be some indication that yes, this doesn't just mean, as we understand it, everything stays the same except all these people are gone. Why no? The marble is more than just that. Okay? We'll come back to that soon. And the entire world spoke one language and similar ideas. Spoke the same language. They were of one mind. And it was when they traveled from the east and they found a valley in the land of Shinar and they lived there. Then each one said to his friend, let us make bricks and we'll burn them. And the bricks will function like stones, and the cement, they'll have cement, pitch will function as cement. Okay, they're involved in a building project. And they said, come and let us make for ourselves a city with a tower, and its head will be to the skies, going all the way up to the skies, tower to heaven. And we'll make for us a name, lest we be dispersed throughout the earth. Then it says that God went down to see the city and the tower that the sons of man had built, and God said, behold, it is because they are one people and there's one language for everyone, and that's what caused them to do this, and now there's nothing to stop them from doing everything which they desire to do. Come and let us go down and confuse their language, that one person will not understand the language of his friend. And God dispersed them from there throughout the earth. And they ceased building the city. Therefore it was called Babel. So here's the origin of Babel, Babylon. Because there God had mixed up the languages of the earth, and from there he dispersed them throughout the entire world. Of course, when you read this story, again, if you read it, what's the problem? Yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense. It's amazing how basic the questions are when you start to study and start to analyze. It's not a question we're not asking for anything deep, we're just asking the plain shot, like, what's going on here? What did they do wrong? Right here we have a society which seems to be completely different. First, we're reading about this horrible society filled with all types of sexual deviations, a bunch of animals and killers killing each other, a total breakdown. And here we find very creative people, very unified. In fact, it's amazing how it's so totally opposite. It's such a complete discrepant contrast. It's the exact opposite. And it seems neither one is good. Neither situation is good. It's not good when they're at odds, right? Break down. And then here they're totally unified. So it's not clear what they did wrong. What were they doing that was bad? Where is the sin? Something was happening, because it says that God came down to see the city and the tower. And God doesn't say what's wrong with it. He just says that what the cause is. The cause is because they all speak one language. And now there's nothing to stop them from what? From whatever they desire to do. But what is it that they desire to do? And whatever that is, the only solution was to stop them from what they desire to do was to introduce new languages. This does give us an insight into the origin of the phenomenon. Ask a teacher in college sometime, why is it that there's different languages? How did it develop? Why? And why is it that people exist and there are different nationalities? That's one of the most pressing problems of our day all over the world. There's a zillion different groups that speak different or a slight dialect, and it causes tremendous strife, right? Nationalistic, ethnic strife. That's one of the major problems of the post-Cold War era. So the Torah is speaking about this over here, but here we have we see that this was not, by the way, this was not the way things were intended to be by nature. By nature, the entire world would have spoken one language. And by nature, you wouldn't have had nationalism. It came about as a result of God's will, as a punishment, as it were, although we're not clear what the sin is at this point. Anybody? Chazal say that on top of the tower, there was a sword, which was pointed towards heaven. So what does it mean? It means that the city they were involved in building. Now, building a city, getting together, building a city and a civilization is not, nothing wrong with that. It's all right. But it seems at a certain point they became involved in a different type of an activity. Yeah, they built the tower, and what do you need a tower that goes all the way to heaven? It meant that it had a certain symbolic significance, and they were involved in a war, in a certain type of a war against God. It was the deification of man. See? And man, this is a very prominent emotion in people. That is the desire to glorify and to deify the works of man. You have that in all they have in today's society too. That's another, that's the essential of Avodah Zarah, idolatry of the day, the worship of man. And as man being the highest form of existence in reality. And this expresses itself, of course, it has to have something to express itself. And it expresses itself usually in great building projects, architecture, tremendous architecture. It's an expression of the grandeur of man, which the psychological significance is deification. So, that's what seems to be the interpretation. That was the where I wanted to show the development between the two. Everything that I've said until now, the definition of the Dar model, the definition of the Dar fly, I didn't go into all the elements. I'm saving some for later. Because we still have to ask what the relationship was between having the same, speaking the same language and all this unification to the building of the tower. We haven't gone into that. I'm going to bring it out later. That's basically, as I said before, those are the ideas of Rabbi Shea. I'm now going to sort of like work the two strands together. What I want to do now is to compare the two. And I want to address it by raising a few questions. First of all, we mentioned that it is a little bit strange. You have a story of two societies. And they seem to be two totally different societies. One is engaged in lust, in a loss of control over the instinctual. The other one, quite the opposite. Very, very disciplined, right? Just the opposite. Very much in control. Very well organized. And very much involved in building and construction. Unity. Now, is there a connection between the two? In other words, are these simply two separate societies? You have, the Torah is telling us the story of two, they just happen to exist. Two societies, they both existed, and one has nothing to do with the other. That's one possibility. Or no. There is a relationship between the two. In other words, it's not by accident that, for example, the Dar Pluga engaged in what it was doing. Its sin is, well, let me put it a different way. Is its sin completely unrelated to the model, to the event of the flood? Or does it find its origins in the debris of the flood, so to speak? That's one question. You understand what I'm getting at? Is there a connection between the two? Let me put it a different way. At this point in the exposition, it's clear that what motivated them to build the city and the tower and so on and so forth was the fact that they all spoke one language. It was a tremendous unity. So let me ask you a question. Didn't these same factors exist at the time of the flood? All those factors existed at the time of the flood. Yet how come it was no protection against what occurred, the breakdown, the total absence of any type of unity? Why, in fact, didn't the people at the time of Noah get together to build a city and a tower and so on and so forth? Since the very same elements, right, which caused which caused them to be involved in doing these things existed at that time as well. It's not that after the flood they all developed one language. It just that's describing what existed from the beginning of time. So they all spoke one language. They were all the same, so on and so forth, and yet a totally opposite result. So that's what I'd like to try and elucidate. I raised the question before, and I said that on the surface, it would seem that the mob was simply an act of destruction. But Chazal interpreted it differently. And basically they say that it was two things simultaneously. It was destruction and recreation. Destruction and recreation. That is to say that God implemented certain changes in the nature of the universe, in the nature of the world. Climactic changes, and we can't depict every one of them, but there was a complete change in the natural forces that affected man. And we see, what's the proof of this? For example, man, the most significant result of this is that man emerges as a significantly weakened creature as a result of the mammal. First of all, the tremendous lifespan that man enjoyed, lifespans of over 900 years, it begins to get shorter and shorter, shorter as the generations, until it reaches more or less, what we're familiar with today. Okay? What other proof is there that man has become weaker? From afterwards, when God blesses Noah, God blesses Noah and his children, and he tells them to be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth. Take a look at this is chapter 9, Pasuk Beis. God tells him that the fear of him will be placed on all the wild animals and birds of the earth and birds of the sky. Everything has been given in your hand. Which means that at this point in time, God places the fear of man in animals, which is another thing, that animals have a natural fear of man. But of course the question is, why was this necessary at this point? It would seem that this did not exist. This fear of man did not exist before the mammal. Okay? Now why? So, there's a very famous medrash that's brought down in the Yalkut Shimoni. And it gets at the underlying factor which was responsible for the breakdown of society in the time of the flood. And I'll just quote it to you. Reb Yitzchak said, quoting as though God is saying it, what caused them to rebel against me? Is it not because they would plant once, and for a very long time they wouldn't have to plant again for a long time? Once in 40 years they would have to plant, and they would travel, man would travel from one end of the world to the other in a very short amount of time, and he'd uproot the cedars of Lebanon as he went along, and lions and leopards were like a flea to him, were like nothing to him. And why was it? Because of the nature of the climate, the air, and so on and so forth. What's the idea of this Chazal? The idea of this Chazal is that man prior to the flood was a completely different being than what we know after the flood. He was the most powerful being in the world. He was more powerful than any animal. The lions, leopards, the tigers were like nothing to him. So therefore, that explains why there was no need for God to place the fear of man in the animals, because by nature, man was the most perfect, was the most powerful animal in the world. And that's why he lived such a tremendous old age. Because everything was designed for him to be in the most perfect physical state. He was in a completely different physical state than what we know of right now. We can't even imagine what it's like. Now, how does that tie in with the sin? How does it tie in with the sin? What does that do with the chayt? I'm sorry? The answer is, what's the first thing that Noah did after he came out of the ark? He brought a carbon to God. Even Noah did not bring a carbon before. Because what's the problem? When a person has this tremendous sense of being all-powerful and almighty, it means to say that he had no need. Since he became corrupt, he became totally caught up in his own ego. He was a tremendously powerful figure. There was a tremendous feeling of self-confidence and deification of the self. The individual ego was totally powerful, all-powerful. It's totally different than anything we can imagine right now. When he had, as a result, and Noach himself felt the change immediately when he came off the ark, he immediately felt a certain weakness. When man feels, that's the way people are. When do people sin? When all sin is based upon a certain self-image. That's why when people act differently when they're young, a person is young and powerful, he thinks he's going to conquer the world. He can't imagine any restraints. It's all when they have a certain self-image of being a conqueror. He's going to live forever. He's filled with this sense of himself, this tremendous sense of himself. In that framework, he can't control himself. Now, man, God created man in such a way, of course, the reason why God did it was for man's benefit, that man should have tremendous physical power and be able to utilize the energy for the service of God. But when he became corrupt, then he became filled with this tremendous sense of self-confidence. He had no need for God at all. And this resulted in two different things. First of all, complete indulgence of all of his desires. That was the first thing. And when a person is beaten low, when a person is suffering from a low ego, say he doesn't enjoy any of the pleasures. That's where you see, like, people change. Or when people experience sudden success in the world, whether it be in business, they make a lot of money, or actors, right? If a person is struggling, very often you read that person, he was struggling for a number of years and then he became discovered. And he was married to the same person for 20 years, everything was fine. Suddenly he's a tremendous star, and now he's going out with all kinds of women, his family, he got divorced immediately. Suddenly he's a totally different person. Well, what happened? The answer is, it all depends upon his self-image. And when a person has, self-image is the most significant factor in the control of sin. When a person has a self, you see that, by the way, expressed, that's the mitzvah of the Yifas Torah. That's the one the Torah gives. The conqueror, when the army is victorious in war, so it allows him to have a relationship with a conquered woman, even though she's not Jewish. And Rashi says it's a concession to the Yetzer Hara. Why? Because in that situation, he wouldn't control himself. Why? Because at that moment, he has that sense of being a conqueror, unbeatable. When a person's in that framework, and you see it in our society today, I mean, people who view themselves as being heroic dimensions. So it led to an inability to control the instinctual. That's the first element in the breakdown. And the second element of the breakdown was he's totally consumed with himself, the deification of the individual ego. So there's a complete inability to acknowledge the validity of any other ego. He's totally caught up in himself. That was the cause which led to the corruption. Yeah. Again. When we asked before, we said that it doesn't make sense. Why does God promise that I'll never bring destruction, I'll never destroy the world again? Also, the reason given, because the inclination of man's heart is evil from youth, doesn't seem to make sense in its own right, right? And also, it seems to contradict what the other pasuk said, that I'm going to destroy man because the inclination of his heart is only evil all day long. Even now we can understand. Because since the cause of the sin was that tremendous sense of power that he had, such that his need to have a feeling of deification was gratified within his own personal ego, that's what caused him to do it. So the punishment was that there had to be a complete change in the nature of his ego, a total breakdown of his strength, and a total breakdown of that type of an ego. That's why God said it'll never happen again. Because the man that emerges after the flood will be in a much weakened state, as man is now. He won't live that long, and in fact, he does have to be afraid of animals. The only reason why he's not afraid is because God had to place a special fear in the animals, but it's not because he has superior power. He's not the strongest being in the world. There are beings that are much stronger than him. And every man is subject to illness. Before the flood, there was no such thing as illness. You see, he traversed from one end of the world to another, and he lifted mighty oak trees and so forth. Tremendous power. But after the flood, he can never again have that feeling of being superhuman, except min Uro, in you. You see? That's what it means. Ki yetzer levi, inclination about a man, yes, it is evil, it does have that capacity, but it's not kol yom. It's only at a very limited point in time. When he's young, a person is young, for a short period of time, he has these crazy fantasies. But then he gets a little older. And you don't have to be too old. He gets a little bit older and suddenly starts to get injured already. Even an athlete. An athlete, that by the time he's 30, he's already an old man. And he's a powerful figure. And no one can escape it. Every person has injuries, breakdowns, this happens, that, all kinds of problems. Disappointments, and it's just an impossibility. He'll never again be able to sustain that type of a feeling of self-glorification. And therefore, what brought the world to that level of corruption was this tremendous feeling of self-confidence and self and power within the self, so that he had absolutely no need for God. You know, when a person is weak, when do people turn to God? When people are mighty and they're successful, they don't need God. But then when they become weak and they experience in the jailhouse, you know, when people go to jail, that's when they begin to think that maybe there's more to this world. That's what God is saying. Of course, it was totally just to destroy the world at that point. And God is not changing anything about that, but God is, the Pasuk is explaining to us that the Mawa brought about certain changes. And these changes will create a new type of an Adam who will never again reach that type of a level of corruption in which he's glorification of the ego as such that it causes a complete breakdown of the boundaries and of all the factors which maintain society together. That's the difference between the two Tzvikim. The first Pasuk says that the inclination of man's rock kol hayom, throughout, he's capable of reaching a level where he's always feeling the sense of majesty. But afterwards, it won't be that way. Only min Ura. But once he gets a little bit older, he's not going to feel that way anymore. Why did he create man that way in the beginning? There's one answer. Because that was the best way to create man. This was really... Man rebelled because of a good that God had. That's the irony. That man takes something which is a good, which is intended for his benefit. Isn't it a benefit? Wouldn't it be a benefit to have tremendous power, not to have to worry about being attacked by any of the animals, or to have to worry about sickness and to waste one's time and energy on all the things that people waste their time and energy on today just to maintain themselves, their existence, physically and so forth? And to have that type of strength, it means to have that type of psychic energy to be involved completely in study. If that was used properly, if he had used, like people that did do that, like Shane, like Adam Tzadikim, if a person would use that type of energy and that type of longevity properly, he'd reach a tremendous level. So it was all for the benefit of man. But of course, man has the capacity to take a good and make it into a bad, yes? What's the relationship between the Dor HaMavol and the Dor HaFlod? That was the question. In other words, I said, are they two isolated phenomena? Or is the Dor HaFlod related to the Dor HaMavol? Right? Now, one question we can answer immediately. I said before, all the elements which created the tremendous unity of Dor HaFlod existed at the time of the Mavol. They all spoke one language, right? And so forth. And yet it did not bring them together. Why did it bring them together? Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a good point. Now let me see what happened over here. We've said that in the time of the Dor HaMavol, so man found an outlet for his need, the need for glorification of the self. It's a human need, the glorification of the self, the deification of the self, found its expression in the form of the individual ego. Because the individual ego was extremely powerful at that time. Now, as a result of the flood, the individual ego was broken. Individual man was nothing. He felt very weak when he came out of the uh, as a result of the flood, because the entire situation had changed. He could no longer have that type of feeling, except in youth, but that then is gone. So what happened? What took place? Now, in order to understand the story of the Dara flood, of what took place, you have to understand a couple of psychological principles. I'd just like to elucidate them very quickly. I said that there are basically two significant psychological principles that the Torah is introducing us to at this particular point. The first principle is, and that is that the ego hates to give up an object that it's become attached to. You understand what I mean by that? When a person has become attached to an object, whether it be another person, a love object, you fall in love with someone and you lose the person. Either the person dies, let's say. The ego resists, has tremendous resistance to relinquishing the object. You know what I'm talking about? By relinquishing means to remove the psychological attachment to that object. And rather than give up an object, what does the ego seek to do in a situation like that? Replacement. To find a substitute. That's the principle of substitute formation. That you find illustrated, as Jackie points out, in the story of Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, and Joseph. That the in the story of Chazal say every one of the three, Yaakov and the brothers and Yosef, each one was punished for their own defects. And the mistake of Yaakov was the excessive attachment, emotional attachment to Yosef that had to be broken. That's why the Ashkacha was that Yosef should be separated. But you see, at first, even when he thought that Yosef was killed, he did not separate himself psychologically. He did not withdraw the energy from that attachment. But rather, instead of doing that, which he was supposed to do, and to redirect that energy towards his relationship to God, he found a substitute. Who was the substitute? Binyamin. As we see, he kept Binyamin behind. He wouldn't let Binyamin go. Binyamin now became the favorite. That's why the plan of Yosef entailed a situation where Yaakov would be forced to separate from Binyamin, because now Binyamin was really psychologically a substitute for Yosef. So the first principle is that the ego, by nature, when it's faced with a situation where it has to relinquish an object of very powerful attachment, will have tremendous resistance, and it will seek to find a substitute. That's the principle number one. Principle number two is something very interesting in the ego. This is a very fascinating thing about the human ego. The human ego will always seek, everybody has ego. That's a very powerful thing. Everybody's got, ego. Everybody's trying to, in one way or another, to satisfy their own ego. Now, the natural way in which a person seeks to gratify his ego is what? Is through himself, by being something alone. His own personal ego. When you think about, about enjoying the feeling of ego, you mean in a personal sense. Like you did something. So you get the credit. Okay? But we know that the ego can gratify itself in a different way. It can gratify itself directly, but what's the other way in which it can? The ego. Exactly. Somehow or other, it's an amazing thing, and it's very prominent, again, with teams. Sports is a tremendous force in our society. And you take a look at the people in the stands, they're yelling and screaming, and if their team wins, there it's like ecstasy, it's the greatest joy. If the team loses, it's like their world is destroyed. And you see, in many cases, tremendous fights break out. It's like, now, what happened? Was it effect? You didn't do anything. The truth of the matter is, if people were totally logical, neither feeling makes any sense. Because what did you do? What do you mean your team won? Five people on a basketball team who have nothing to do with you, don't even know you, don't even care about you, beat five other people who don't know you, and there's, what's the difference? What do you have to do with this? How do you, as a result of these total strangers, how is your ego affected by what happened to these people who you have no relationship with whatsoever? And yet we see the emotion is as though the greatest Yatino people are when their team wins, or when your team wins, when you're in high school, it's all the same thing. It's like the greatest yelling, it's like great as though something fantastic happened to you. But what happened to you? Now how do you explain something like that? The answer is that a certain psychological process is going on over here. You've expanded your ego. Your ego is no longer just restricted to you, but that's me. That's called identification. I'm part of them. psychologically. Now, logically, it doesn't make any sense. I want you to realize it. This is the most irrational, illogical emotion that people can feel. But it's so pervasive in our society, they encourage it. They encourage this feeling as though it's something great. That's the whole thing. That's the whole emotion of nationalism during the Gulf War and the big victory and so on and so forth. It's all you. You feel a tremendous sense of personal elation. It's not an objective thing. Well, I think for the interest of mankind, it's better if America should win. That's not the feeling, and you know it. Because the ones on the other side are the same, you know. It's basically a very powerful, it's a resurgence of pride. We all feel pride. What do you feel? We didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't do anything to help the war effort or anything. You know, you didn't do anything. Oh, but that's not enough. But there's a collective ego. This can happen in two different ways, by the way. This can happen on a personal level, where you form a relationship with somebody else. Now, that person is an extension of your ego. For example, parent and child. Yeah, people live their lives through their children. Very often. I mean, it's a very pervasive thing. They're through their children. And very often, that's exactly what the whole thing of parenting becomes all about. Parent has unsatisfied agenda, unsatisfied wishes, couldn't fulfill, so now it's going to be fulfilled through the child. But it's not you, it's the child. Yeah, but it's me. That's called nachas. when it works. When it works, it's called nachas. Okay? When it doesn't, it's called irrational parental interference. You know, not another word. But also, that's on a personal level. But by and large, the most prevalent form of this is something which I believe had its origin at this point. Something new developed at this point. Something which never existed before. The origin of the group ego. What I'm saying, this is the aspect of my own interpretation, is that before the time of the flood, there was no such thing as a group ego. You couldn't conceive of a group ego. Why? Because the individual ego was so powerful, the primary thrust of the ego is to satisfy itself through the individual. Certainly, I'm not going to, if I have no choice, I'm weak, so I have to join up with a team, I need a partner to help me. But if I could, you see, but in doing so, there's a sacrifice. You see, on the one hand, you have to realize, psychologically, there's a sacrifice. When they interview someone, the hero, without the team, was what a team effort? Without the team effort, you see, to the extent that it's a team, it takes away from your own the amount that you can personally enjoy. You'd certainly prefer a personal achievement, which nobody else gets any credit whatsoever. It's all me, because that's the real feeling. If ego is your thing, then you don't want to share it with anyone. And to the extent that you realize that it's not just you, it's part of a team, it diminishes. On the other hand, so why do I join a team? Because I realize that I'm too weak to do anything on my own. And there's just no way. The individual in this world is so limited and counts for so little, right, that in order to be a somebody, you got to get a team. So you want to be the president. You want to be great. So you want to be the president. But you can't be the president unless you have a country. And you can't be important unless you're the president of a great country. So now you need a country. You need others. Now, of course, when you're raving about the success of the country, it's all the country you're giving credit. What do you really mean? Psychologically, it's you that's taking the credit for it. You see how it works? That's how it works after the model. Prior to the model, man had no interest in a group ego because he was totally preoccupied in individual ego. And that's why there was no idea, even though they all spoke the same language, there was no concept of getting together, unified, and building in a building project together, because that's done. That requires that people band together because of a group ego, which required a certain state of individual weakness to have that banding together. Now, what took place after the flood? Man sensed his weakness. I'll take questions after this. I want to try and get everything out now. He sensed his weakness. And because of this weakness, he had to turn to God. But I don't think he was that satisfied with the situation. Because a certain part of him was yearning for what he had lost. That ego feeling. That tremendous ego feeling that he had lost. He had to give it up. What God demanded of him was that he give up that irrational ego feeling, which wasn't in his interests. But instinctively they began to band together because they were weak. And the ego was depleted, so they needed each other. And when they got together, they began to function. See, there was a tremendous factor. All the elements which make for harmony were there. Identification. They all spoke the same language. Is a very, very significant factor which brings people together. So they began to get together. And they began to build. And as they were building, and as they were experiencing the satisfaction, it awakened something within them. You see, remember I said the ego does not like to give up an object, to renounce an object to which it had become attached. What was the object over here? The glorification of man. The glorification of man, they sense, perhaps unconsciously, could now be achieved in a new form through the group ego. So what came into being was a group ego. And once they got a hold of that, there was a tremendous momentum to keep going. And you see, the group ego works differently. And you see, what do they say? We'll make a name for ourselves. I would say there was another change in the ego. Before the marvel, the ego was extremely powerful by nature. See, there's two kinds of ego. We live in a state of depleted ego. Depleted ego. Man's ego is depleted by nature. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. This feeling of so what do you do? So each person has to. The whole society is consumed today with the question of self-esteem, and you have to build up self-esteem. And say, in education in school, you got to tell a kid that he's fantastic, he's special, he's an individual, he's wonderful, he's unique. That's the method. By keep repeating to people how special and wonderful they are. To me, that method is totally superficial and absurd. I'm not saying that that's the goal, that people should feel great, but even in that framework, it doesn't make sense. Because nobody ever feels great because he keeps repeating to himself that he's great. People feel good because they achieve something. It's a natural result. If you, instead of concentrating on that, give the person skills. If a person has skills, then he can accomplish something, so he feels pretty good about himself. Now, we all start out from the premise of depleted ego. That came into being after the flood, as a result of the weakening. Before the flood, man didn't have to do anything to feel good about himself. He just felt a natural sense of strength. There's certain type of people that naturally always feel, you know, you envy them. They always feel good about themselves. They never see, at least that's the way it seems, they never experience any self-doubt. You've all met people like that. They just have a certain natural confidence. They haven't done anything to justify it, but they have a natural confidence. And you wish you could feel that way. Like, you always worry, and you prepare, and you plan, and you don't want to make any mistakes, and if you do good, you feel good. But other than that, you're always worried. And this person has, prior to the flood, man didn't have to make a name for himself. He was great by nature. What's the name? Who needs a name? I'm great. Afterwards, he was in a state of depletion. And he needed something from the external world to bolster. He now was in a situation where he had to resuscitate. It was a broken ego, and he had to resuscitate it. That's the way we live today. Each person goes into lives his life, and it's there with a broken ego, and he has to resuscitate it. There's nothing wrong. I mean, that could be the impetus to work hard. There's nothing wrong with legitimate feeling of feeling good about yourself, as long as you don't get a crazy feeling of being something which you're not. That's the idea. They sought to reconstruct their broken ego through joining together, because it can only be through a group ego. And since that time, man is weak. And every person, by the way, every Russia, like Hitler and all the others that sought to promote this idea of the deification of man, it always was in the form of a group. For Hitler, I mean, of course, in his own mind, it's him. He's the greatest. But it's through the Aryan race. He needs the German people. Well, if you feel, really, when he speaks about the German people, psychologically, he really means himself. Right? He's not giving credit to somebody else, because he wants to feel that he's the supreme being. But the point is, it's impossible for him to make that claim, because people would just laugh. He's just one person, he's nothing. So therefore, he's the embodiment of an entity which he now can proclaim is the ultimate form of existence. And every other group, every other dictator that's seeking to satisfy this emotion can only be through the form of the group ego. It can't work any other way. That was the idea of the tower. See, they needed a building project. They needed a group. They needed unity. They needed to make a name, a tremendous accomplishment. And there was only one thing standing in their way. God. They needed to eliminate God. That's what it means, that there's nothing standing in their way. And now, God is telling us what the causation is. It's the unification, which again I gave them for a good purpose. They should be unified. One language. One language, one culture. Right? They were of the same mind. This is what's causing them to misuse all these things in an attempt to glorify man. And if I don't stop them, then the very thing which God wanted to achieve with the model, to bring about a situation in which man would be subordinate to God by breaking the individual ego, is now going to be undone by man's getting around that and constructing a group ego. Because only a group ego had the possibility of achieving that type of an emotional situation. So that's why God had to step in and break that up. And that's why, what's the methodology which broke it up? Creation of many different group egos. All the factors which caused the identification was the same language, so now many languages, and many groups, and many people. And one group will never be able to achieve that state of hegemony. There's always been, no matter how many, it's about any history, any period of time, empire, no matter how much, there was always another empire, there's always another country, there's always another group. So no particular group could ever reach that stage where they be able to have such a feeling of power and glorification that they'd eliminate the idea of God. The idea of God would always be part of mankind. Okay. The last point that I wanted to make was that from this story we have an insight not only into why mankind is divided, different languages, different groups, and so forth, but in terms of the question of world peace, is the situation as we know it, now man has always been in a state of war, every time and every place, is the situation as we know it something which is subject to a political remedy through some mechanism like the United Nations or the New World Order, you know, President Bush or anything like that? Or is it something which is part of the Hashgacha? It's something which God implemented into the creation, and it will not be eliminated except in the time of Mashiach. Now, I believe that from this story, this is what the story is talking to, the extent to which we can derive lessons which relate to our situation today. It means that it's not by accident that man is in a perpetual state of war. It has a moral element as well. It serves a moral purpose. It's a necessity. Now, again, it's a necessary evil. The fact that men should be at war fighting each other is not a good thing, but it is certainly better than if man was completely unified and in a state of war against God. Then man would have no basis for existence again. He would no longer be defined as man. So it's a necessary situation. And this situation will terminate in Yemos HaMashiach. Because then the entire world will be unified, but this will be a different kind of a unity. What will be the purpose of the unity? The unity will be based upon the fact that the entire world will recognize the truth, the existence of God. That's a completely different phenomenon. That's the proper unity. Ki mala ha'aretz deyas Elokim, because the world will be filled with the knowledge of God. When mankind is filled with the knowledge of God, then the idea of the deification of man will be completely absurd. And people will run from that idea. It'll be the worst. That'll be our avodah zarah. They'll recognize what a terrible avodah zarah that is. And then all of the energy of mankind will be directed towards perceiving the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is the true unity. That's the real unity. And only in that framework will there be a situation of peace. Situation of peace. So just let me make two concluding comments relevant to the Yom, and then I'll take questions. First of all, I started off by saying that I was being Omer Dov B'Shem Omer, because much of what I said, just about everything, I'm just, the shir is really Rabbi Chase, it's not mine. I just made some additional points here in terms of connections. But Chazal say that it's made the Geula Olam. It brings a redemption to the world. And redemption, we're talking about Mashiach. So I was just wondering, what's the connection? Why this particular good quality of saying over something and something, you know, attributing to the person who is the author? Why is that so significant? So I think that the answer is, because as we said, what is the essence of Yemos HaMashiach? People will be, what will bring about the state of peace? it'll be that people will be totally involved in the love of Chachma per se. Lishma, for the sake of the love of God's wisdom. And they'll be totally involved in the Avodas Hashem. See, people are involved in Chachma today too. There aren't many people that are devoted to Chachma and Torah. But it's, see, the situation is, of peace is only if the appreciation of Chachma is not based upon ego, but it's based upon an objective love of the truth itself. And to the extent that Chachma is a means, which you find in many situations, it's in the secular world, in college, and even in the Jewish world. Even among scholars, there's a tremendous amount of ego involved as well, a certain amount of lolishma. Not to say that there's anything evil, but it's not the highest level. So the idea of that, to the extent that people perceive among Torah, people who follow Torah, that their motivation is not really the love of God, but it's just something they're using for their personal ego, to that extent, it prevents people from a real appreciation of Torah. So all that Dev B'Shem Omro means that you're taking Torah out of the realm of being a personal ego thing. You're saying over something, it's a nice idea, and you're not taking credit for it, because you're only concerned about the truth, and you don't care about the personal ego. So that's what it means, that when people are in the habit of studying Torah in a way that it takes it out of the framework of being another ego gratification, that's the idea of the redemption. You're bringing mankind closer to the redemption, because that's the essence of the redemption. That people recognize what the true good is. What's the true good? The love of Chachma. And therefore all the other things, wealth and other manifestations of glorification of the ego, they'll be gone. And the other thing I wanted to mention, perhaps no gear to the Inyan of the Yoma, that Shivas B'Tammuz initiates the 3 weeks, culminating in Tisha B'Av, is mourning for the destruction of the Middash. And basically the entire situation of the exile, of the Golos, and which we know will only be terminated with the advent of the Gula, Yemos HaMashiach. And here too, we have to be very careful, because we're in a situation where there's been a significant change. The fact is that we have been able to regain, in a political way, in a practical way, Eretz Yisrael, the return to Eretz Yisrael. So we should realize that too evokes a lot of emotions. That I mentioned the emotions before, the emotions of nationalism, of triumph, and we relate to Israel that way. And I'm not saying anything wrong with it to a certain extent, but we should be cognizant. You know, if Israel is victorious in the war, so there's a tremendous euphoria. And that euphoria doesn't necessarily stem from attachment to the true ideas of what Eretz Yisrael should be all about. That we should relate, as a matter of fact, if we relate to Eretz Yisrael and appeal that it's just another nationalistic phenomenon. So that's every people have their country. The French have France, so we're nationalistic about Israel. That's a distortion. That's not the purpose of the Jewish people. That's not the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. The purpose of Eretz Yisrael is not to be another expression of nationalistic gratification, nationalistic emotion. But rather, the whole purpose is to be a society which is founded upon the ideas of Torah, to bring people closer to God. And that's the way, that's the idea, that's what we should learn from this, and the way that we should relate to the entity of Eretz Yisrael, to realize that precisely when people began to relate way back when people began to deviate from viewing Eretz Yisrael as a means of establishing a Torah society, and it just became another nationalistic entity, and that's when God decreed the punishment of Golos. Because that's a corruption of the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael, to just serve as another nationalistic expression. And now that we've returned, we have within our power to rebuild the society in Eretz Yisrael, we should not relate to it in that manner, which is simply a continuation of the Golos in the physical boundaries of Israel. But rather, our whole relationship should be one which we seek to utilize what we have to create a Torah society and to bring people back to Torah. And hopefully, by the idea that I just mentioned, when we relate to Torah in a manner of Lishma, and thereby indicate that our whole basis is the genuine appreciation of a Torah for its own sake. Okay, I'll stop here and I'll take questions. The depleted ego requires externals. It's in the world of externals And it's in the world of the relative as well. A name. What's a name? It's all in the world of relative reality. It doesn't mean anything objective. You say, I want to make a name for myself. That's an expression of you. I want to make a name for myself. Why do you want to make a name for yourself? So I'll feel good about myself. But why don't you feel good about yourself right now? See, that's the way depleted ego functions. So depleted ego is a result of the marble, and the development of group ego comes along with it.